So you prepared to come this morning. You got everyone dressed. Most everyone brushed their teeth. Maybe put on a little deodorant. And you made it in one piece. It didn't take a lot of preparation, but you were able to get here. Some of you are venturing on some summer vacations or have just returned. It took a little more preparation for that adventure. Prepare to gather up enough articles of clothing to make sure that you had enough gas in the vehicle, depending on how far you were going. If you went through the experience of getting married, you know what kind of preparation that took. For the man, you just had to show up on time, pretty much. For the woman, she had a little more time put into it, whether you hired a professional wedding planner or you just had a mother and mother-in-law that wouldn't leave you alone and they did it for you. You had much to prepare for. And as I sit down and I counsel young couples who are preparing for their wedding day, it's always fascinating to discover how little they have prepared for their marriage. The wedding is the least of your worries. The marriage is lifetime. I would venture to say in our lives, most people spend more time planning their Friday night out or their vacation than they do preparing for their life. Sit down, you get online because you can click around and find good deals, get a Groupon for the restaurant down the street, get a Groupon for some kind of beach house somewhere that you can go and relax. But there's no place online you can go and say, I want to click a few things and prepare my entire life. No, that takes a little more time. And I think sometimes we avoid such planning or thinking about because it's complex. Or maybe it's just too large and we know that ultimately we can't plan everything out because we have limited sight. We know very little about tomorrow, much less a year from now, 5 years from now, 15 years from now, 100 years from now. We know very little, and we know that God will allow certain things into our lives to take us in different directions. But does our limited sight require or expect us to take a backseat approach and just say, well, God's going to plan it all anyway, therefore I will be passive in my life and just whatever happens, happens. Que sera, sera. Taking a Buddhist approach, some type of foreign God situation where you do nothing. Does God have a desire for you to be actively preparing for whatever He has in store for you? Though you may not know the big answer to the question, what is? Is there a boot camp of life that prepares you for the unknown down the road? Daily disciplines in the Scriptures, of prayer, of connecting with the church body, of growing in Christ, and just being ready for whatever He has in store for you is your calling. Does God prepare for anything? Does God think ahead about anything? Or is God as confused about the future as you are? There are those in our, actually in the evangelical church, I hate to even say it that way, because I would consider this theology very errant and outside of the faith historically. But there are those who have promoted a view that says God does not know the future, for the future has not yet happened. So God is in a position of a responder versus an initiator. That is a false theology if you read more than a half a page of Scripture. God who makes promises doesn't promise hoping something will happen. He knows it for a fact because He can cause it to happen. God is a preparing God. He's never shocked, surprised, caught off guard, He is not only aware, he is intimately involved in every aspect of this world, and he is preparing for the culmination of the display of his glory that is in all of the earth. I'll remind you, this book does not mention the name of Yahweh or Jehovah or Elohim or any of the names of God. It never gives any spotlight on God per se. With the major actors in here, we've got Ahasuerus, and we have Mordecai, and we have Esther, and we have Haman, and a few others sprinkled in. The spotlight goes on them at various portions of the book, but at no time does the author put a huge spotlight on God. So it is upon us as readers, just as it is us in this life as we live, we must look in the way where we may not see God physically, but we know He is there, and He is the one orchestrating the events that are happening. God is not absent or removed from the book of Esther. Neither is He removed from your life. He is very present. So as we look in here and throughout the entire book of Esther, I want you to have this in mind, that God is there and He is active, and it is upon the Spirit and your dependence on Him to see God acting in the various places in Scripture. David prayed in the Psalms before he would go into the Scriptures. He prayed a verse, "God, help me to see the wonderful things in your law." Why would David spend any time praying such a prayer? Could it be that he, like you and I sometimes when we sit down to have a quiet time or we're reading the Scriptures to our families, that we run through the text and we check the little box and we're done, but it made no spiritual impact and we didn't really see the glory of God in that? Could it be that we need the Spirit's help to see what we see? To hear what we hear? For Jesus said in Matthew 13, for seeing they do not see, and for hearing they do not hear. Why? Their hardened hearts would not allow it. So let us pray through this book. God, help me to see wonderful things about You in this book. Help me to see You. For I look through a glass darkly, but I know Your glory is there. If you can do that in the book of Esther, I think it will equip you better to do that in your life. When you just don't see Him. And you don't have a handle on things, and things are out of control, and you've done things that you're having a hard time even forgiving yourself, and you wonder if God can forgive you. God is there. So let's look at the book of Esther. Turn there, if you will. Here's a phrase I'm going to begin with, and I'll end with today. God is never surprised by circumstances, nor ever at a loss for a prepared servant. We're going to look at three things today in this section, chapter 1, and then just the beginning of chapter 2. And I'm going to give you just three big picture items of where I see God acting through these things. The first thing you'll see is this. God acts through places of nobility. You see in verse 1, it says, "Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus." I gave you a little history lesson last week, but let me remind you a few things and add some things to that. Ahasuerus is the king of Persia. The Medes and the Persians had combined. Years before, the old Persian Empire was led by Cyrus the Great. He conquered Babylon, where the Israelites were captive from Judah, were captured and living under Babylonian rule. Cyrus the Great and Persia came and conquered Babylon, and Cyrus the Great allowed the Jews to begin to go home, go back to your homeland. You can read about that, just the portion of that in Ezra chapter 1, that he actually felt God desired for them to go back to their homeland in Jerusalem to rebuild. Cyrus died about 9 years later. After Cyrus, his son, his oldest son, Cambyses, then took over, and he ruled for 8 years and then was killed. Cyrus led for 20 years. His son, Cambyses, led for 8 years. Then his second-born son, Bardiah, took over as king, and he led for just a few months. He died en route to a battle. After that, a ruler comes up in Persia named King Darius, who is not a son of Cyrus. Darius took over, and he ruled for many years, and he continued to expand the kingdom. When his life was over, this is Xerxes, or as we see him in this text, Ahasuerus. Xerxes or Ahasuerus. He is the son of Darius. So he's the fifth king of Persia. So Ahasuerus, the son of Darius, is now king, and he is king for 21 years. It's during this time, the third year of his reign, 483 BC, that we find the beginning of Esther. The timeline of Esther is 10 years long. So as you read this, I know they've captured this and put it into a movie for about 90 minutes. But in reality, life didn't happen in 90 minutes. It happened over 10 years. Likewise for you and I, when we see the hand of God, God does not move in our 90-minute time frames. Sometimes He moves over 10, 20, 30 years. But that does not mean God is not active and fulfilling His ultimate will. In this section of the first 9 verses, you're going to see 3 banquets. I can put it in kind of a context where you can see this. 3 lavish banquets, and there's a reason for this. You see the first banquet in verses 1 through 4. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus. The Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 120 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel of Susa, in the third year of his reign, 483 BC, he gave a banquet, first banquet that we're seeing, for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days. You see how many days there was? How many does it say in your translation? 180 days. Now, how many of you would love to go to a 6-month party? It's quite impressive. He's got 127 provinces, and throughout 6 months, he's bringing in all the military officials, kind of a rotating thing as he goes across all of India through Ethiopia and bringing them in over a 6-month time period, all the military officials. Why is he doing that? You know, as I read Scripture and I look at things, and if the author doesn't give it to me, it makes me inquisitive. What's going on here? Why bring them all in? Is it just that he likes to party? Or is there a purpose here? Is he preparing for something? He's obviously trying to display his riches and impress certain people in the community throughout the entire region. Well, what he is doing here is that he's bringing in all the military officials because he's trying to impress them and get their approval about going and battling Greece, because he would like to expand the kingdom. So he wants to go to Greece, and he has to get them behind this idea. His father had already tried and was defeated. Now, this was the largest kingdom in all of the world, and they're trying to expand. But Greece is coming up and growing. And as Darius had led some troops out many years before, and they fought at the Battle of Marathon, they were defeated and came home. So now you have Ahasuerus who wants to, in a sense, take revenge or to expand where his dad wanted to go. But many in his culture did not think it could happen. They had been defeated once and thought, you know what, we're large enough, we don't need to expand into Europe. So he had to wine them and dine them and impress them and bring them all in over a 6-month time period in order to gain approval that we can and will press on. So he's bringing them all in over these 6 months. 180 days. The second banquet you'll see after the 6 months starts in verse 5. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. For all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. The way I envision it and what's happening here from history is that over 180 days, he would bring in the various army officials, the nobility of who had the money and the fight power to be able to accomplish it. He brought them all in over a six-month time period. Then, at the conclusion of that, he holds a seven-day party where everybody comes in, from the greatest to the least. He needs the entire community behind this. We're going to go and take over Greece. We can do it. Yes, we can do it. You can imagine the kind of pressure he was under as the lone voice, is what I understand, the lone voice who desired and thought they could accomplish it. And he has to, from one man, has to impress and convince everybody else. Six-month party, smaller groups, seven-day time period, everybody's there. This is the last sell in order to convince everybody. He's displayed his marvelous kingdom. He's displayed his marvelous wealth. And he's going to display some marvelous food. If you notice in the court, in verse 6, there were hangings of fine white and violet linen cloth held by cords of fine purple linen. And he had the best. They were on silver rings and marble columns and couches of gold and silver. On a mosaic pavement of marble, mother of pearl, precious stones. Verse 7 goes on to say, drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. You didn't have to. But it was available. For so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Don't make them do anything, but whatever they want, give it to them. We're trying to make them happy. We need their support. You see this building up to here. And in the midst of all this, God is behind the scenes orchestrating what's happening. Ahasuerus, like a salesperson or a politician, he wants to take you out in order to close the deal. And as a proud man, Ahasuerus knew how to deal with the pride of people. Oh, you know in Proverbs 16, verse 18, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. All this elaborate display of wealth, of food, and kingdom was no guarantee for victory. He was just convincing them based on what he could do, but he could not promise a victory. But Ahasuerus needed to know, as every ruler and every person in authority needs to know, is that you are an authority because God has ordained it. And you are under His ultimate rule. You know Romans chapter 13, verse 1 says that God puts every ruler in place. Every person is to be in subjection to the ruling authorities. For there is no authority except for God. And those which exist are established by God, whether you like them or not. But as Pharaoh learned the lesson, Nebuchadnezzar learned the lesson, Belshazzar learned the lesson, even in the New Testament, Herod Agrippa learned the lesson, God is the one who establishes and ordains, and God is the one who can replace you. Ahasuerus hadn't learned that yet. You see, the third banquet in this section is in verse 9. Another banquet is going on during these 7 days, and it's Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So the amount of pressure building up for Ahasuerus during this time period, he's got to convince them, to encourage them, to get them on board so that they can go and do that which his father was unable to do, to conquer Greece. So with this places of nobility, God is orchestrating something here through this timeline. The second thing you'll see where God is working is through the petitions of anxiety. I see here that there was Ahasuerus who was very anxious about these times. You understand the history now, what's happening here and what kind of pressure he's under. He's put the best of his wealth on display. He's put the best of his food on display. He's brought all the army officials and nobility, and now from the greatest to the small, there. Everything's on display. He wants a group think. Everybody look around. Everybody's here. And look at all that we have. We can surely conquer Greece. The one thing he has yet to put on display his most precious treasure, his wife, Queen Vashti. And there's where some anxiety begins to happen. Under that kind of pressure, the husband begins to put pressure on his bride. He makes the request. He wants Vashti to be displayed. You look at verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus, to bring King Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. So he makes the request, go ahead and bring her out. She's the cherry on top of this ice cream that I'm presenting to the people. She is the best. I've shown you all my beauty and everything. Now I'm going to bring out the queen. So certainly she would want to come out and be displayed. But that's not how it happened. Went from the request to the refusal. Vashti wouldn't come. Verse 12, it says, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. I mean, she's over at the banquet with all the ladies, but now he's requesting her presence in front of all these people, all the men. Then the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. Basically, according to that system, she was sinning in three different ways. Consider this. She was a woman challenging the authority of a man. In that system, that was a sin. The second, she was a wife that was disrespecting her husband in front of all those that he needed respect from. The third, she was a subject in a kingdom who was disobeying and defying the king. Why did she do this? Have you ever wondered why Vashti refused? She knows what kind of pressure the king is under. She knows what his ambitions are and his goals. Some commentators look at the text, and they look at it real closely, and they say, she's to come out with her crown on. So they jump to the conclusion, and it's possible, that she was to come out with only her crown on. That's it. Come out and display your ravenous beauty, and just wear your crown. And that may be a reason why she chose not to come out. How many of you ladies, if your husband said, hey, we're having a party, why don't you just go get your beautiful hat and just come out here with just that on? Any takers? Any volunteers? No, you wouldn't do that. So that's possible. And she does know that she was being put out there to be put on display, to be the center of all the attention. If you dig in a little of the history, it is interesting. Her name is not Vashti in history, in secular history. She has another name. The queen of that time, with Xerxes, Ahasuerus, was pregnant and about to give birth to Artaxerxes, who would be the son of the king, the next ruler. It's quite possible she was 7 to 8 months pregnant at this party. And whether she only had her crown on or she was fully clothed, he was going to bring her out to display her, and she did not think it was proper. She refused. She denied. And it made him very angry. Is God working through this anxiety of Ahasuerus? Using the opportunity? Not only do you have the anxiety of Ahasuerus, you'll see the anxiety of the council. The king doesn't know what to do. I've got this pressure. I'm trying to convince everybody so we can go to Greece and conquer them and extend the kingdom to take revenge over those who defeated my father. And now my wife, in front of all people, is refusing to come. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king, so to speak, before all who knew law and justice and were close to him. And you see the various princes there of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. He says, according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. What do I do? I've got to be able to convince the people, but she hasn't come and she's made a fool of me. So revenge begins to take place. Vashti would then be banished for life. though not killed, she could have been. Look at verse 16. In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women. You see the anxiety in this man? Causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, Oh, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to his presence, but she did not come. Verse 18. This day the ladies of Persian Media who have heard the queen's conduct will speak in the same way. You see a little overreaction here? The queen didn't do it, so now all women of all places from Ethiopia all the way over to India, all of the women are now just going to go, ha! The queen doesn't have to do it. I don't have to do anything. You just go on, little man, because I'm not moving. A little overkill here, a little anxiety. I wonder if Memucan had a wife that was a little troubling, and he used this to seize the opportunity. King, let's just go ahead and make a law, because I need to get my wife to pipe down a little bit. I don't know. Maybe that's reading into the text. I don't know. But there's something here that, since there's no law about this, they're going to design a law. And he's going a little over the top, in my opinion. They're going to speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. Verse 19, if it pleases the king, out of my anxiety, I'm going to go ahead and tell you what you should do. Let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media that it cannot be repealed. That Vashti may no longer come into the presence of the king Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. A woman who will say nothing. Verse 20. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. This word pleased the king and the princes. And the king did as Memucan proposed. Verse 22, so he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, and every man should be the master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. So instead of just assuming or understanding why Vashti may have not come, the pressure was on, Memucan gave the suggestion proposed, if it pleases you, king, let's just make a rule that cannot ever be repealed, that all women should just go back and be quiet and obey the authority in their home. Let's not only get revenge on her, let's replace her with someone better. Now, in history, I think that's why they did not kill her, though. Could have. Really did a public display of that. But they chose not to kill her because she was carrying the son, the next king. The punishment was banishment from the presence of the king. It wasn't that she would cease to exist. But that's the situation here. He requested, she refused, they got revenge, and now they're going to seek replacement. Is God working in any of this? Is God have a plan through this? He unfolds the story starting in chapter 2. God works in the places of obscurity, or in the people of obscurity. The people that are off to the sidelines, those who seem to not have any attention or spotlight on them, that God has a plan. In chapter 2, verse 1, after these things, when the anger of a king Ahasuerus has subsided, after these things, it's always interesting, we say after these things, after what? Is this immediately after the time they banished Vashti out? No, there's actually a time period here of 4 years between chapter 1 and chapter 2. What do you think happens between chapter 1 and chapter 2 during these 4 years? They launch off into war. This is the season that he's got the support of the people. We're going to go to Greece and we're going to defeat them and expand our kingdom. They go to war, and in 480 B.C., they were defeated in the city of Salamis. A year later, in 479 B.C., working our way down the B.C. calendar, the Persian army was defeated again at the Battle of Plataea. And then Ahasuerus withdrew his forces, never to return again. So during this time, he's being defeated. He comes home licking his wounds. He begins to try to rebuild in his own life. And who does he think about first when he gets home and he needs some comfort and some love? He remembered Vashti, his wife. Now, this is a king who has access to any concubine at any time he desires. But he did not want a concubine. He was thinking of his wife, the one he honestly loved, the one that was his companion. But then what did he remember about her? He remembered what she had done and what had been decreed against her. After this war and things start settling down and he has a little more clarity of thought, remember he was drunk before and he was quickly influenced. The pressure that was mounting, he was drunk and he had to make a quick decision and he agreed to have her banished. Then he goes off to war, he comes back, feelings are resurfacing and he realizes he can't repeal the law. So he loves her and she has borne his son. So what's going to happen? Well, verse 2 goes on, it says, "Then the king's attendants who served him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king.'" Now, it's interesting why the king's attendants had to come to him and suggest that. Certainly, that had already crossed his mind. I just wonder, I don't know this to be a fact, but just kind of looking at the story here, I wonder if those king's attendants thought, if the thoughts of Vashti are coming back up, and the king might try to repeal that law and bring her back because he loves her, she's going to have our heads because of what we recommended. And so, before he can carry on, that Ahasuerus can carry on with that thought, I think they jump right up. "Oh, king, we've got a plan. Why don't we go out and get..." I mean, yeah, you're a little older. You're like, 40 or 45, and your wife was that age. Well, why don't we just trade her in for a couple of 20-year-olds? All right? Maybe that will be better. Let's just get the young ones, and it'll revive your youth. So he thinks about this plan. These beautiful young virgins sought throughout all the kingdom. Verse 3, "Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of the kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, into the harem and into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them." Verse 4, "Then let the young lady who pleases the king, the best of the bunch, to be put in place of Vashti. That she'll make you feel special. She'll be the head woman for you. She'll be the queen. Not just someone to satisfy his immediate passions or pleasures that he desires, but someone who is unique." Remember, the king can have anything he wants, but he's looking for something special. After this, it says, "The matter pleased the king, and they did accordingly." Now, the process was interesting that they proposed. Kings of that day and throughout all times, if they were to take on a wife, not a concubine, but a wife, they were typically people of nobility. People from other kingdoms, where maybe a king of Egypt would come and present his daughter to marry the king of Israel or Persia. And not only would that be his wife, some other king from another country would come and in order to make peace with the land. They would offer their daughter, "You can marry her. She's one of nobility. She's one worthy of you." So throughout all the lands, and he had many, from India all the way to Ethiopia, all these different countries that could provide a wife, an additional wife for him. But the suggestion here was that all young women, unmarried women, it doesn't matter what position they have in life, let's gather all of them. Very interesting. I don't know if they really thought through all of that. But that was different than any other time period that I can find. Surely the king could marry anyone he wanted, but typically it was always a woman of position. And Esther would never have had an opportunity with that type of thought. Man has his ways and thoughts, but God can direct their paths. And so he was setting up, using their ambitions, but opening up the opportunity to fulfill his will. To get a lady of obscurity into a place where she could accomplish what God desired. So you see God in the text here? that things are happening here that are unusual. Why did that happen? Why did they desire just any woman, all unmarried women throughout the land? That God planted a thought in a mind and it was going to be accomplished in order to present the opportunity for Esther. Proverbs 21 verse 1 says, "The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes." Herodotus, the Greek historian, said that not only were young unmarried women gathered from all the regions, perhaps against their own will, but 500 young men were also gathered to become eunuchs. So you can see the distress in all the land. To fulfill the king's desire to have a companion, a queen, many families suffered. Or a young lady who was unmarried, and I wonder how many were trying to get married during this time once they heard. But for the ladies who are unmarried and the pressure knowing they were going to come and capture them, seize them. If they do not become the queen, they're not released to go home after the bachelor show back home. No, they would be kept and put to the side as just a concubine, never to be returned again. If they were captured and didn't win the contest, in a sense, they would be put off to exclusion and probably never see their family nor the king again. For the eunuchs, any desire they had for their future was erased. So you look now in verse 5, going on and how God has now opened up the doors for Esther. "Now there was at Citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite." Mordecai is being placed right at the right time in the right place from the right family, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been in exile with Jehoiachin, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. So now Mordecai, these people of obscurity, in verse 7, we're introduced to Hadassah. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother, for they had died. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Mordecai's raising Esther. They're people of obscurity. They're Jewish people displaced in a land that is not their own. And God has been orchestrating through nobility and through their anxiety, and now through people of obscurity, He's positioning them for such a time as this. A.B. Simpson, who's the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance, said this, "God is preparing His heroes. And when the opportunity comes, He can fit them into their places in a moment, and the world will wonder where they came from." Good. God is always at work, working in the lives of people of obscurity, waiting for the opportunity to put them on display for His glory. You know, God took Joseph from the pit to the palace at just the right time. He took Daniel from the lion's den all the way to the king's palace at the right time. Nehemiah was a cupbearer, but he became a wall builder. He had no experience in that, but God was preparing His people. And now Esther, displaced as an orphan, would now become the queen of Persia. We may not always understand God's ways, but certainly we can trust His will. Charles Spurgeon said, "There is no attribute of God more comforting to His children than the doctrine of sovereignty." One of the catechism questions that is about providence, and the answer is, God's works of providence are His most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing of all His creatures and all their actions. God is a providential God. Creation was a unique work of divine will, causing the world to be. Providence is a continued exercise of that same Creator, according to His own will. He gives all creatures the ability to live and move and have their being. He involves Himself in the events of daily life, and He directs all things to the appointed end. God's hand is completely on and in charge of the world. His hand may be hidden, but His rule is absolute. In considering the book of Esther, I want you to see that providence, God's providence, beyond just His sovereignty, that He's in total control, but God's providence is that He is working things through for an appointed end. Providence. Pro, meaning for or before. And vidence. We get the word like evidence or even video. To see. To see before is what God's providence is. Providence to see beforehand. Some have tried to say God cannot see the future, and therefore God can do little about anything that happens. Others have merely tried to limit God's providence to foreknowledge without control, providence without sovereignty, upholding without ever intervening, general oversight without concern for the details of life, some would say. But the biblical testimony of God's providence is overwhelming. I want us to just capture a thought for the few moments we have left of God's providence in working through all of these details. Questions must raise up in your minds. Here is a king who has his own perverse pleasures of conquering. He has his own ways of getting people drunk in order to fulfill his wishes. He removes a queen. He gathers up young virgins across the land. He makes eunuchs of young men. How is God working in that? Is God intimately involved when people are doing things for their own evil plans and wishes? Is God orchestrating sin? Or is He just allowing it? Is He using it? Those questions have to come to mind. And it's a bigger question than we have time to answer. But I want to give you some thoughts for you to chew on for another week. God's involvement in the world requires various thoughts and statements. A person has the ability to take action. Events may be triggered by natural causes. And Satan surely shows his hand at times. Yet God still overrules. That's the message of the book of Esther. Things that oppose God's law, listen to me, things and people who oppose God's law do not necessarily oppose His will. They actually can be used to fulfill His will in events. People may do things that are evil, yet God, who overrules, can use the people's initiation of evil for actions of good. People will sin, yet under God's overruling, God is not the author of sin, but He is the judge of sin. People's actions can be used for His will. God is involved in all that occurs in the world. I want you to hear me. He is intimately involved in all that occurs in the world. Without violating the nature of things, the ongoing natural processes, or even human free agency. He makes His will come to pass through these ways. Yet it is still a mystery to us who have limited minds and limited visions. But the consistent biblical teaching about God's involvement is that He is involved and His will is always accomplished. That's what the Scripture speaks of. Of all the evils that infect God's world, moral, spiritual perversity, waste of time and goods and souls, and even physical disorders, it can be said God does permit evil, Acts 14:16. God punishes evil with evil, Psalm 81 and Romans chapter 1. God brings good out of evil, Genesis 50:20. Acts chapter 2, verse 23. Chapter 4 of Acts. Chapter 13 of Acts. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. God can bring good out of evil. And God uses evil to test and to discipline those He loves, though He is not the author or the initiator of evil. And one day, this is where I get really excited, one day God will redeem his people from the power and the presence of evil altogether. The doctrine of providence teaches Christians that they are never in the grip of blind forces, fortune, luck, chance, fate, never in that grip. But all that happens, listen to me for your situation, all that happens to you is divinely planned. God is a preparing and planning God. And each event comes as a new summons to trust Him, to obey Him, to rejoice in Him, and to know that all is for your spiritual good and your eternal position. Romans 8:28 ought to be a part of your DNA. God can work all things for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. So it gets down to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, concluding with this verse. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. Don't you love Hebrews chapter 11? You ever read it? The Hall of Faith? People say, yes, those are our biblical heroes. You tell me about those heroes and the lives that they had to live, the difficulties they had to overcome, the endurance they had to have in a God they could not see, but they had faith and a conviction that would see them through. They believed in a God who was a providential God, a sovereign God, who was bringing all of His will to fruition for His glory. And some of them were removed from the earth before all the promises were fulfilled. They didn't get to fully see it. How many Israelites died in Egypt? How many of the Israelites who were captured in Babylon didn't get to see the return? How many have had to expire believing in a God who did not fulfill it while they were still alive, but God was still at work? We have to have a faith. That's the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things we do not see. God, who is not seen, is working all things for our good and His glory. We learn in the book of Esther, we have a providential God who is working in places of nobility even today. Even through petitions of anxiety, He is working His will through that in places and people of obscurity. God is never surprised by circumstances, nor at a loss for prepared servants.